Michael Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about Voltaire, the famous, I suppose, bridging promotion philosopher, who I suppose took other philosophies and really put them into plays, put them into the culture, injected them into the culture. An amazing person. Started off with Francois Marie was his original name, and he quickly remade himself, remodeled himself. Francois Marie Duaret, and I can't really pronounce him. And this is episode 2. I'm reading from the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy, so you get a good cross section. It's not always the best things to read through or processes to read through. I feel that I miss a lot of the science a lot of the time. Emphasize the philosophy, so I definitely miss a lot of the maths. He's crawling his way up French society. It's almost like a board game, being stepped out of the wrong place, banished to Britain, goes back from England back to France, starts to publish a little bit of a thing haphazardly, gets thrown out into the arms of a rather weird relationship with Emily. I forgot if this, her name is De something or other. Again, this is memory work here. What is her name? Bizarrely is, you can imagine how there's absolutely no interest in that at the moment, but he writes something about Newton, and he's put under house arrest, and the hangman of the king's hangman burns his book in public in terms of disgust. Can you imagine a world where people actually cared about this? The majority of people, in fact, if people are saying, you what? You're podcasting about philosophy? This is so out of date. No one really cares and stuff like that. So I should mention, I think, to put into perspective, you've got a series of English philosophers. There's Bacon, who is a lawyer and pretty much like Voltaire in the world of trying to win influence by his own skill with the rich people. It's sort of like an influence system. And he came up with the idea of inductive logic. Newton came up with just Newtonian mechanics, and this is the force of gravity, action at a distance, application of equations to solve things. So the Earth spins around or orbits the Sun due to Newtonian law of gravity. A simple equation gives you the motion of everything. A lot of things coming out from Newton's three laws. These are basic equations. Newton didn't. One of the mysteries, not mysteries, is that Newton, Isaac Newton, or pictures of the dashing person, but becoming a most complex person to read about. I've read a few books about him, and really complex person and surprising person. Has gone into politics, and there's a political movement around him, and his science and politics are one. It's interesting to see that the idea of science being at one aspect a state above politics, sits above politics. Another point, it's actually inside politics. There's a Newtonian belief, an English view, and Locke is like, John Locke is like the boy Robin, but he's coming out, and I was trying to think what he is like the John the Baptist of Newton, John Locke, and, you know, I'm struggling now to, really, he sort of applied inductive logic to, philosophy to actually clear away to some of the more extreme circular beliefs of rationalism, and indeed the rationalists Voltaire attacks. Part of the attack, this is fantastic place. And I will really have to go back and restudy these people and get it into my head what's going on. One of the things that I'm going to start reading from the French Newtonian to the Enlightenment philosophy. So this is sounds like getting France back on its feet again. And you've got to remember, this is before the periodic table. This is before we knew chemistry. This is before we knew what oxygen was. There was actually very little science actually understood in the early Enlightenment. But another interesting thing is that I think of the people being kicked out, not being able to practice, and go, "Why? I think I recognise. Oh, that's a bit like myself. I've been kicked out away from the establishment. I'm saying the wrong things, and so I see that. And then people having a system of cronyism, where you get things. I say, I recognise it. So there's lots of elements of the Enlightenment, the grubby side of the Enlightenment, which I actually think is operating in our current society. People believing absolutely fad, stupid things. It's like it really feels like the United States is a bit like Imperial France. With regions and, you know, sort of great potential, great minds going, you know, knocking around the place. But, sort of, like, you had the crazy king and the people with the establishment, and the poor people in the United States, sexual workers aren't doing all that well with it, and fundamental change coming in, and, you know, bubbles, market bubbles, GFCs, all this thing happening in the background. Although it is completely different, it feels the same. Also, the role of science fiction, i.e. Bacon wrote his science fiction book, which I'll have to go back and remember the name of his science fiction book about an island that people go to and they practice science and the Royal Society method. You've got the use of fiction in Gulliver's travels, and he's starting to use the work of fiction. He writes a fictional support of Newton, and that's enough to really upset people. And it's one of these strange things is that people take fiction rather seriously, and it's why we take sort of Hollywood seriously. Indeed, Voltaire was making his critique of the French establishment is in a fictionalized world. I don't know. I find it extremely so. He's fictionalized these fictional letters. These fictional letters are enough to really upset people, and it sort of means to me it's the. Way that we tend to have a fictionalized world at the moment, the fictionalized people of, like, class is a fiction and wealth is a fiction. But we'll go across. I must be some sort of Marxist in there. So the French, from the French Newtonian to the Enlightenment, 1.5, from 1745 to 1755, I think he carks it in 1770 something or other. So the periods of his life. So see when he's carking it. So carking is the Australian word for, I suppose you have the word. I don't know if you have that word overseas, if you're an overseas listener. Carking, 1778. This is when he carks it. 1778. 1769, 1770 is when Australia is discovered. So this is all sort of like this, if you can understand the madness. Like, look, truly, Cook and Banks, they were barking mad, as far as I can see. You know, by today's standard, these people were barking mad, but mad enough to go on a voyage three times in a boat. This is Cook. Sort of mad enough to start Australia. Sort of, like, Australia is an Enlightenment experiment. Sort of. So the Enlightenment, for me, as you read it, it's got all these different levels. You've got establishment, you've got the people... thinking ahead, you've got debauchery, all these stupid things happening. The apparent victory of the Newton Wars of 1730 to 1740s allowed Voltaire's new philosophy identity to solidify. So the Newton's laws are when Newton came up and knocked Descartes just off the soapbox in many ways. So Descartes had these sort of very flimsy... Descartes invented equations, there you go. So Descartes did an awful lot of things and had a method of improvement of mind, of entire philosophy. Newton just had this rambling set of equations and just was a very forceful personality. Here that sort of got swept up into the politics at the time became a political thing, Descartes did perform experiments, exploratory experiments, but he didn't have systematic experiences. Really interesting to think about. Especially crucial was the way that it allowed Voltaire's outlaw status. He was an outlaw philosopher. Have you seen this man? He's famous, and he's living up in a chateau, which he had never fully repudiated, to be rehabilitated in the public mind as necessary and heroic defense of the philosophical truth against the enemies of error and prejudice. From this perspective, Voltaire's critical stance could be reintegrated into the traditional old regime society as a new kind of legitimate intellectual martyrdom. The old regime is the king. Since Voltaire also coupled his explicitly philosophical writings and polemics during the 1730s and 40s with an equally extensive stream of plays, poems and stories and narrative histories, many of which were orthogonal in both tone and content to the explicit campaign of the Newtonian Wars, Voltaire was further able to re-establish his old identity as an old regime man of letters despite the scandals of these years. Wacko. So, not Carl Sagan, but there's sort of various celebrities. And, there's one which, such and such there's someone who used to be in a rock band, made a professor. Okay. Especially when you hear his science, I've forgotten his name, Professor, I can see him, but I can't remember his name. This is part of the rehab I have to do. Okay. In 1745, Voltaire was named the Royal Historiographer of France. So what does that mean? Title bestowed upon him as a result of his history of Louis XIV and the Swedish King Charles II. This royal office also triggered the writing of arguably Voltaire's most widely read influential book, at least in the 18th century, Les Mémoires des Spires de Nations, Donations, mate, 1751. Sure, I've got that in my... I think I might read a few of Plato's plays, but Plato's... works. A pioneering work of universal history. I must admit, there was this, back in the days in the army, there was this hopeless soldier. I won't mention his name, or he'll come up and punch me. But he was just hopeless. And then it came to him to give a weapons lesson about the Browning gun. So if you can imagine a World War I type of pistol. Completely useless piece of, you'd be better off carrying a rock than one of these pistols. But, and I say a rock, and he said, he started off with the lesson he had prepared for it, and he said, throughout history, man has been hurting other man. first we began with a rock, and then he went through it, and it was just beautiful history. So I think people want histories of nations. Position also legitimated him as an officially sanctioned savant, whatever that means. After, in 1749, after the death of Du Chatelet, the little Emily Du Chatelet, Voltaire reinforced this impression by putting an invitation to join the court of the young Frederick the Great in Prussia, a move to further assimilate him with the power, all power structures of Europe. And it's Frederick the Great, the person that he is also utterly, utterly mad, and he is the person that Hitler loved, Frederick the Great. Look, there is just so much drenched in history. I was expecting to be just some sort of boring enlightenment, inaccessible figure here. There's a creeping sound here. I hope it is not a snake. I just have to look. Sort of slithering sound. He had this assimilative trajectory continued during the remainder of Voltaire's life, his legacy in the history of Western philosophy might not have been so great. Oh dear. Can you imagine he's going to stuff it up? Yet, during the 1750s, a set of new developments pulled Voltaire back towards a more radical, controversial identity that allowed him to rekindle the critical philosophy persona that he had innovated during the Newtonian-Newton Wars. We just don't. No, I'm teaching you. I can't believe it was Newton Wars. The first step in this direction involved a dispute with a one-time colleague and ally, Paris-Louis Moreau de Maupertuis. It sounds like a frog if I've ever come across. Look at that name. Pierre-Louis Moreau de Maupertuis. Maupertuis had preceded Voltaire as the first aggressive advocate for Newtonian science in France. When Voltaire was preparing his own Newtonian intervention in the Lettres Philosophiques in 1732, he consulted with Maupertuis, who was by this date a pensioner in the Royal Academy of Sciences. It was largely around Maupertuis that the young cohort of French academics, Newtonians, gathered during this Newtonian Wars. Oh, this is rich on. 1730. I love Newton Wars. No one has ever heard of this stuff. Well, I'll be sanctioned. People say it's irrelevant, or haven't you heard of it? You never win when you talk with people. And with Voltaire fighting his own public campaigns on behalf for the same cause during the same period, the two men became the most visible parts of the French Newtonism, even if they never really worked as a team in this effort. Like Voltaire, Maupertuis also shared a relationship with Emile Du Chatelet. One included mathematical collaborations that far exceeded Voltaire's capacities. I wonder what Emily did. Maupertuis was also an occasional guest of Curie. Siri, C-I-R-E-Y, so it's a different way of Siri, and a correspondence with both Du Chatelet and Voltaire throughout these years. But, in 1745, Maupertuis surprised all French society by moving to Berlin to accept the directorship of the Frederick the Great newly formed Berlin Academy of Sciences. Oh, God, I'm your Frederick. He loved you. He is just, you know, the history of Frederick the Great. I wonder if he can ever get readers. That's too sordid to read. Maupertuis thought at the time of his departure for Prussia was turning towards the metaphysics and rationalist epistemology of Leibniz as a solution to certain questions of natural philosophy. So Leibniz is sort of mad as a cut snake. I read it. I think he's got some beautiful maths in it. But he was hated by Newton, Leibniz, because he dared to say, I thought of something you thought of first, Leibniz. He's also in this weird, weird world of coming to the conclusion. He sort of took a bet on quantum mechanics and took the wrong bet and just got completely stuck up on something called monadism. On Oh no, Duchelet also shared this tendency, producing in 1740 her Institutions de Physique, a systematic attempt to wed Newtonian mechanics with Leibnizian rationalism and metaphysics. Oh my God, Father. I'm going to have to reread Leibniz. But Leibniz is just this confused... He's not that, not other, but he's really disappears up his own bum. Voltaire found this Leibniz turns, deceptic, and he began to craft an anti-Leibniz discourse in 1740 that became the bulk of his brand of Nietzscheism. So he, oh God. So Leibniz was actually not allowed to go to Britain because he upset Newton. This placed him in opposition to Duchelet, even if his intellectual rift in no way soured their relationship. Yet, after she died in 1749, Voltaire joined Maupertuis and Frederick the Great's court in Berlin. This anti-Leibnizism became the centerpiece of the rift of Maupertuis. Ah, oh, God. I don't think Leibniz even knew he was this influential. Voltaire's public satire of the president of the Royal Academy of Berlin's Sons of Berlin, published in late 1752, which represented Maupertuis as this would be a real gripping piece of satire. So it must be, was it a play? Despotic philosophical buffoon forced Frederick to make a choice. I don't get the Germans to make choices. Bloody hell. He sided with Maupertuis, ordering Voltaire to either retract his libelous text or leave Berlin. Voltaire chose the latter, falling once again into the role of the scandalous outlaw philosopher. So, for me to actually try and get Leibniz. So Leibniz started off with, he was a part of the rationalist view, which is against the British view. Okay, so the British view eventually said, "Well, let's take some data first, let's check out what nature has to say." Whereas Leibniz said, I've got this handy book here called, The Bible. What does it say? God is right. Okay, let's see what we can work out. So he had a sort of mathematical view of working out what God is and come to the a series of God conclusions. Some of them absolute whack. Well, I'll have to reread it. So I'll see if I can find another source on Leibniz and reread it. Okay, 1.6, fighting for the philosophy. So he's done Newton, he's pissed off the Newton, he's found a way of getting into Newton in a different way. Of course Newton was actually being, I think he's actually good, he was actually pulling it. And so he's got a new brand of hyper-Newtonianism, which is called Fighting for the Philosophy, 1755 to 1778. That's when he carks it, guys. So that's, 5 and 18 gives you 23 years, good old quarter of a century of this philosophy. This event proved to be Voltaire's last official rupture with the establishment authority, because he's going to die. Rather than returning to his home in Paris and restoring his reputation, Voltaire instead settled in Geneva. When this austere Calvinist enclave proved completely unwelcoming, he took further steps towards independence by using his personal fortune to buy a chateau of his own in the hinterlands between France and Switzerland. Voltaire installed himself permanently at Ferney in early 1759, and from this date to his death, he made the chateau his permanent home and capital, at least in the minds of his intellectual allies of the emerging French Enlightenment. Just imagine Calvinists, Voltaire rocking up to Calvinists. And of course, it's strange, like the Calvinists have been through Britain, the British Civil War, so in Britain it's sort of it's sort of like Europe had gone a bit with the Calvinists and then gone party time, and Switzerland's still pretty austere place. During this period, Voltaire also adopted what would be his most famous and influential intellectual stance, announcing himself as a member of the Party of Humanity, devoting himself towards waging a war against the twin hydras of fantasism and superstition. So this almost sounds like the political party one, but he says fanaticism and superstition. God. While the singular defense of Newtonian science he had focused Voltaire's political energies in the 1730s and 1740s, after 1750 the program became a defense of the philosophy tout court and the defeat of the perceived enemies within the classical aristo-monarchist monarchical establishment. And I sort of side with him because there is nothing more awful than people saying, "Oh, I love the royal wedding. For real. Oh yes, it's so good. And I vote this way, that way. And oh yeah, well, what are you doing? Oh, let's watch the royal wedding. Oh, Godfather." Okay, so I'm with you, Voltaire, but I mean, in this way, the Enlightenment philosophy became associated through Voltaire with the cultural and political program encapsulated in his famous motto. Well, it's French. He has to give you a French motto, but it's got a circumflex in there, a acute. Écrase la fame, crush infamy. Oh, well, that's a pretty simple. Why don't let's crush infamy? This Enlightenment philosophy with social criticism and reformist political action continued historical outcome of Voltaire's particular intellectual career will become the most lasting contribution to the history of philosophy. Well, talk about someone who lives with people, has chateaus, personal fortunes, moves around, and pisses off everyone he works with is just a genius. The first cause to govern his new program was Dirot's and Lambert's Encyclopedia. The first volume of this compendium of definitions appeared in 1751, and almost instantly the work became buried in the kind of scandal to which Voltaire had grown accustomed. Voltaire saw the controversy as a new call to action. He joined forces with the project soon after its appearance, penning numerous articles that began to appear in the volume 5 in 1755. Scandal continued to encase the encyclopedia. However, in 1759, the work's publications privilege was revoked in France. And the act did not kill the project, but forced it into illicit production in Switzerland. This is a banned encyclopedia. This is just priceless. This all this time, sort of Britain is trying to work out. Britain is losing the fight. So all this time, the French are saying, it's the most important thing to look at is the eclipse. And of course, Britain, just bungles diplomatic relationships and saying, oh God, we're going to have to send out our own expedition. And they get Australia coming up. During these scandals, Voltaire fought vigorously alongside the project's editor to defend the work. Choosing the encyclopedia's enemy, particularly with the Parisian Jesuits, who edited a monthly periodic called the Journal de Trevaux, into a monolithic infamy devoted to eradicating truth and the light of the world. This framing was recapitulated by the opponents of the encyclopedia, who began to speak of the loose assemblage of authors who contributed articles to the works as a subverse colliery of philosophers devoted to undermining legitimate social moral order. okay, like a typical fight which goes out, you can't really pick out who's doing what, but the Jesuits are involved. It's Jesuit trained, it always goes on. This polemic crystallized and grew in both energy and influence. Voltaire, from his chateau just sitting on the Swiss border, haha. Voltaire embraced its terms and made them his cause. He formed particularly close ties with D'Amber, this is an encyclopedia person, and with him began to generalize a broad program for enlightenment centered on rallying the newly self-conscious philosophies, a term often used synonymously with the encyclopedists. What? Towards political and intellectual change. In this program, the philosophers were not unified by any shared philosophy, but through a commitment to the program of defending philosophy itself against perceived enemies. They were also imagined as activists fighting to eradicate error and superstition from the world. The ongoing defense of the encyclopedia was one rallying point, and soon the removal of the Jesuits, the great enemy of the Enlightenment, the philosophies were claimed, became the second unifying cause. God. This effort achieved victory in 1763, and soon the philosophies were attempting to infiltrate the academies and other institutions of knowledge in France. One climax in the effort was reached in 1774 when the encyclopedists and a friend of Voltaire and the philosophers Anne Robert Jacques Tujeau was named Controller General of France, the most powerful ministerial position in the kingdom, but newly crowned King Louis the 16th. Well, you've got this. This is warfare. This is amazing stuff. But what I don't understand, so that is Anne Roberts must be a bloke. Okay. Voltaire and his allies have paved the way for this victory through a barrage of writing throughout the 1760s and 70s that presented philosophy that espoused by Tujeau as an agent of enlightened reformed and as critics as prejudicial defenders of an ossified tradition. What I can say is the Climate Council. It comes to mind as the Climate Council. We've got rid of it, and it's controversy. It's sort of amazing to see how it goes. Voltaire did bring out one explicitly philosophical book in support of this campaign. His Dictionnaire Philosophique in 1746 and 1770. What it strikes me is that, what makes me think is, like, totally different, but Karl Marx, the idea of your philosophy and the idea of your thought being taken up by the people and fighting it. This book republished his articles from the original encyclopedia while adding new entries conceived in the spirit of the original work. Yet to fully understand the brand of philosophy that Voltaire made foundational to the Enlightenment, one needs to recognize that it is just as often circulated in fictional stories and satires, poems and pamphlets, and other less obviously philosophical genres. Voltaire's most widely known text, for instance, Candide ou Optimisme, first published in 1759, is a fictional story of a wandering traveller engaged in a set of farcical adventures. Yet contained in the text is a serious attack on the libertinism philosophy. Oh, God. One that in many ways marks the culmination of Voltaire's decades-long attack on its philosophy started during the Newtonian Wars. Now, truly, Leibniz philosophy is completely whack. I.e. that goes like this. God's a good guy. Things are happening bad here, so this, even though it's crap, it's the best possible world because God is a good guy. And other things. And, he's, if you write down what he says in terms of quantum mechanics, it's clearly, no, that's not wrong. No, I can hold up a test tube and prove you're wrong, mate. Okay. Philosophie à la Voltaire also came in the form of a political activism such as the public defence of Jean Calas, who Voltaire argued was a victim of a despotic state and an irrational, brutal judicial system. So it's really interesting that I think Voltaire was just too big for his boots and so couldn't exist in Berlin. And Frederick the Great's a pretty amazing person. Voltaire often attached philosophical reflection to his political advocacy, such as when he facilitated the French translation of César Becquerel's treatise on human justice and penal reform, and then prefaced the work with his own essay on justice and religious toleration. Calais was a French Protestant prosecuted by the Catholic monarchy. Now, people just don't think of systems of justice. It's pretty amazing. Public philosophical campaigns such as these that channeled critical reason into direct opposition against the perceived injustice and absurdity of the old regime life were the hallmark of the philosophy, as Voltaire understood the term. So you can see the Enlightenment breeding the French Revolution and the metric system and a whole lot of really interesting science to come from the French Revolution. But and it's also interesting that his life makes sense in terms of the old system. He actually living an old system life, having affairs and hating people and writing things and making fortunes. Voltaire's philosophy, icon of the Enlightenment philosophy, that is, after he carked himself, 1778 to the present. God, we're going to have to go more than this, mate. Oh, yeah, okay. Voltaire lived long enough to see some of his long-term legacy start to concretize. I've never heard that word before. Not in that sense. With the ascension of Louis the 16th in 1774, the appointment of Turgot as Controller General, the French establishment began to embrace the philosophies of their agenda in a new way. Too late to save you from the revolution. Chop, chop. I wonder if Turgot gets chopped in the head. Critics of Voltaire and his program of philosophy remain powerful, however, and they would continue to survive as a necessary backdrop to the positive image of the Enlightenment philosophy as a modernizer, progressive reformer, and a courageous scourge against the traditional authority that Voltaire bequeathed to later generations. During Voltaire's lifetime, his new acceptance translated into a final return to Paris in early 1778. Oh, you're not going to last too long, mate. Here, as a frail and sickly octogenarian, Voltaire was welcomed by the city as a hero of the Enlightenment that he now personified. A statue was commissioned as a permanent shrine to his legacy, and a public performance of his play Irene, wow, was performed in a way that allowed its author to be celebrated as a national hero. Voltaire died several weeks later after these events, but the canonization that they initiated has continued right up until the present. He is, you know, off arms. So I would like to see the play Irene. I wonder if you can just hit on the internet Irene. It'll be probably played by dreadful actors. Just a vomit inducing play about female astronomer. I can't remember her name, L or something. It's dreadful plays. Western philosophy was profoundly shaped by the conception of the philosophy and a program of Enlightenment philosophy that Voltaire came to personify. The model he offered in the philosophy as a critical public system advocate, first and foremost, and as an obtuse and systematic thinker only when absolutely necessary. So he only systematically thought when it's necessary, was especially influenced in the subsequent development of European philosophy. Also influential was the example here. Oh, there you go. Mentioned Karl Marx again. I felt a similar vein. You can see down the page. Well, there you go. I hadn't read this, but I had immediately began to think of Voltaire and Karl Marx. Also influential was the example he offered of the philosopher measuring the value of any philosophy according to its ability to affect social change. In this respect, Karl Marx's famous thesis that philosophy should aspire to change the world, not merely interpret it, owes more than a little debt to Voltaire. The link between Voltaire and Marx was also established through the French revolutionary tradition, which similarly adopted Voltaire as one of its founding heroes. Voltaire was the first person to be honored with a reburial in the newly created Pantheon of great men of France that the new revolutionary government created in 1791. Can I say, I want to see the Pantheon. We've got Foucault's Pendulum of the Sun. It's a science. It's a church change to science. This act served as a tribute to the connections between the revolutionaries saw between Voltaire's philosophical program and the cause of revolutionary modernization as a whole. In a similar way, Voltaire remains today an iconic hero for everyone who sees a positive linkage between critical reason and political resistance it predicts of progressive modernizing reform. I suppose what I see is that if you also really see Voltaire in relation to his context, like he was in the context and against the context. So he lived and operated in terms that made sense to the context, but he was also in the context of this madness and standing up against it. And you can sort of take it, you can side with him, or you can look at him in the way that he behaved in his context, and you can also look at the context. Similarly today, if you want to stand up and say anything, you've got to be digitally connected and people have got to worry about you and you've got to sell a product. You can perceive a problem, but you can also perceive the sort of real sleaziness of society. Australia is a great place, but ultimately, under scratch the surface, it's a pretty sleazy place. Okay. So that was his life, and this is the second project. I really like how the people writing this were actually taken by Voltaire, and it's actually added a bit of a thing to it. I think it would be good while, if you're studying this, you'd really want to watch a few of his plays, or read Bacon's book. You know, I cannot think of Bacon. I know he wrote a book, Francis Bacon wrote a book. I can't think of its name. There you go. Remembering molecules and things like that, but I cannot think of it. Part 2. Voltaire's Enlightenment philosophy. What was it? Voltaire's philosophical legacy ultimately resides as much in how he practiced philosophy and in the ends towards which he directed his philosophical activity as in any specific doctrine or original idea. Yet, a particular philosophical position he took and the way that he used his wider philosophical campaigns to champion certain understandings while disparaging others did create a constellation appropriately called Voltaire's Enlightenment philosophy. It's a beautiful constellation. These little things, it's out there, you can see the little things twinkling and went into a beautiful, beautiful word to use, constellation. And so there's Newtonian anti-Descartes, then anti-Leibniz, which is, what did he actually believe in? True to Voltaire's character, this constellation is best described as a set of intellectual stances and orientations rather than as a set of doctrines or systematically defended positions. Nevertheless, others found Voltaire as both a model of a well-oriented philosophy and a set of particular philosophical positions appropriate to this stance. Each side of this equation played a key role in defining Enlightenment philosophy that Voltaire came to personify. You know what I said before about his position? So you look at him and his position and who's made out of it. And I suppose the thing I'm saying beyond this is how you can critique our current society without actually having to get up there and be on the news. Because this, unfortunately, we live in a world where things have to be newsworthy in a grab. 2.1, liberté, liberty. Central to this complex is Voltaire's conception of liberty. Around this category, unfortunately I've read so many philosophers I'm going to have to go back and read Leibniz. Voltaire's social activism and his relatively rare excursions into systematic philosophy also converge. In 1734, in the wake of the scandals triggered by the Lettres Philosophiques, Voltaire wrote, but left unfinished at Crilly, a Traite de Métaphysique that explored the question of human freedom in philosophical terms. Now, Locke says, John Locke says that we, out of chaos, we elect a leader, but the leader has got certain responsibilities. Now, this is a different side of the equation to it. What did Leibniz say? I really can't remember. I have to reread it. The question was particularly central to European philosophical discussion at the time, and Voltaire's work explicitly referenced thinkers like Hobbes and Leibniz, oh God, while wrestling with the question of materialism, determinism, provincial purpose that was central to the writings of the so-called deist figures such as John Toland and Anthony Collins. Gee, Anthony Collins doesn't sound much. The great debate between Samuel Clarke and Leibniz over the principles of Newtonian natural philosophy was also influenced as Voltaire struggled to understand the nature of human existence and the ethics within the cosmos governed by rational principle and impersonal laws. That's interesting. Because you can have, so there's deduction, induction, but there's also these other methodologies which can be applied, sort of systematic sanity checks. Yeah, that's interesting. Voltaire adopted a stance in this text somewhere between strict determinism of rationalist materialists and transcendent spiritualism and voluntarism of contemporary Christian natural theologians. So that would be Leibniz, is the latter. The transcendent spiritualism and voluntarism of contemporary Christian natural theologists. For Voltaire, humans are not deterministic machines of matter and motion, and free will thus exists. So I think, Descartes said animals are just machines, and Leibniz said, look, they've got a soul. God. But humans are also natural beings governed by innumerable natural laws, and his ethics anchored right action in a self that possessed the natural light of reason immaterially. This, that, and I think we just say, look, here are the laws, do what you like, and pay a fine if you do the wrong thing. This stance distanced him from the more radicals like Toland, and reinforced this position by adopting an elitist understanding of the whole and the role of religion in society. For Voltaire's, those equipped to understand their own reason could find proper course of free action themselves. But since many were incapable of such self-knowledge and self-control, religion, he claimed, was necessary guarantor of social order. This stance distanced Voltaire from the republican politics of Toland and other materialists, and Voltaire echoes these ideas in his political musings, where he remained throughout his life a liberal, reform-minded monarchist and a sceptic with respect to republican and democratic ideas. Well, there you go. This is sort of elitist. If you can think your way through. Elsewise, you need cop cars going around the slums to get everyone to beat them in the places. So he's a monarchist. Of course he would be, I suppose. And this is sort of interesting. Yet, he's buried in a republican shrine. In the Lettres Philosophiques, Voltaire had suggested a more radical position with respect to human determinism, especially in his letter on Locke, which emphasized the materialist reading of the Lockerian soul, that was then a popular figure in the radical philosopher's philosophical discourse. Summary is singled out in this part of the book as the major source of its controversy, and in a similar vein, the very materialist account of Eme, A circumflex M-E, or soul, which appeared in volume 1 of Deroitte's and D'Alembert's Encyclopedia, was also a flashpoint of controversy. Voltaire also defined his own understanding of the soul in similar terms to his own dictionary philosophy. What these examples point to is Voltaire's willingness, even eagerness, to publicly defend controversial views even when his own more private, more considered writings often complicated the understanding that his more public and polemical writings insist upon. In these cases, one often sees Voltaire defending less careful reasoned positions on complex philosophical problems than adopting a political position designed to assert his conviction that liberty of speech, no matter what the topic, is sacred and cannot be violated. You can imagine that. Especially if you're censored, one of the things you want to say is, look at me being censored. Voltaire never actually said, quote, "I disagree with what you say, but I will defend you to the death. You're right to say it." Yet, the myth associated with his name remains very powerful. I think I said something else was mythical. Oh, yeah, Newton in the head, apple in the head, and I was just told, well, keep that to your head because you're going to make science bloody boring without it. One still hears his legacy invoked through the redeclaration of this pronouncement that he never actually declared. Part of the deep cultural tie that joins Voltaire to this dictum is the fact that even while he did not write these precise words, they do capture, however imprecisely, the spirit of his philosophy of liberty. In this voluminous, which is really interesting, it's almost as though in this he's become, everyone before him is two-dimensional, he's become three-dimensional, in my view. In his voluminous correspondence, especially in the details of many of his more polemic public tests, one does find Voltaire actually in a view of intellectual and civil liberty that makes him an unquestioned forerunner of the modern civil libertarianism. He never authored any single philosophical treatise on the topic, however, yet the memory of his life and philosophical campaigns was influential as in advancing these ideas nevertheless. Voltaire's influence is probably present, for example, in Kant's famous argument in his essay, "What is Enlightenment?" That enlightenment stems from the free and public use of critical reason. Is that beautiful? Oh yeah, I believe so. And from the liberty that allows such critical debate to proceed untrammeled. The absence of singular texts that anchors this linkage with Voltaire's collected works in no way removes the unmistakable presence of Voltaire's influence upon Kant's formulation. Well, that's interesting. That is interesting. Oh, I've got to really go back. So we're at 52 minutes in. I'm running out of steam here. And we've got next thing is called hedonism. Isn't that beautiful? See you soon. Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.